Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's how you know the big banks are getting healthier. They're serving coffee again at shareholder meetings. Seriously. What really happens behind those closed annual meeting doors? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Thursday, the 19th of April. Good as always to have you with us. Shareholders at First Merit Bank, that's a regional outfit out of Akron, Ohio, took their lead from their peers at bigger and better-known Citigroup today. They rejected a $6 million pay package for their chief executive, same as Citi shareholders did the other day for CEO Vikram Pandit. Matthias Rieker covered the Citigroup meeting down in Dallas for Dow Jones Newswires. He's been to bunches of others as well. So we called him up to get a sense of what actually happens at these annual meetings. Matthias, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. So tell us what it was like in that Citigroup shareholders meeting when they decided they didn't want to pay Vikram Pandit $15 million.
So when the vote was actually announced, it was at the end of the meeting and people were already ready to leave. So the reaction was surprisingly calm.
Was it? It sounds almost boring.
It was. There were a couple of shareholders who actually made fun of that, and Chairman Parsons responded.
Dick Parsons, the chairman. Yeah.
Exactly. How comfortable it is for him and the company to be in Dallas, away from New York.
Right. Well, when these meetings are in New York, not just for Citi, but for all these big banks and companies, what's it like? I've got visions of a hotel conference room that has, you know, weak coffee and stale cheese danishes in the foyer, and then everybody goes in and sits down and listens to some discussion.
That is pretty much correct.
Okay,
it is. Sometimes you don't get coffee at all. Last year was actually the first year in several years that Citi started serving coffee again,
wow,
which was noted at the time as one of the signs that the company had improved.
Come on, no, really? We get coffee and that's why. Oh, gosh. All right.
But banks actually have it within their headquarter building. Maybe 50 people attend. It's usually regulars.
Is it possible for an average shareholder, somebody who owns 100 shares of Citi or Wells Fargo or whatever, to go in there and get a turn at the mic and talk to the CEO and say, why are you driving my shares into the ground? I mean, does that happen?
Yes, it happens quite a bit.
Huh.
Most of the people who speak are actually shareholders who own a couple of shares or a couple of hundred shares.
Right.
This is their opportunity. And they ask questions from why is the share price down to why don't you do more to support retail banking customers. It's a broad, broad range of things, even political questions about the economy, about the president.
So here comes the extremely cynical question, and it goes like this. Are these meetings any more than some kind of kabuki theater, right, where the board members say what they're going to say, the shareholders and the big institutional investors say what they're going to say, and then everybody goes about their merry way and nothing really changes?
The meeting in Dallas clearly shows that there can be changes. You
mm-hmm.
can influence company behavior through these shareholder meetings. And if you look at other parts of the world, in Europe, for example, companies frequently have to hire soccer stadiums to fill
wow.
all the people in who want to speak at these meetings. So if we think about democracy and corporate democracy, this is really a platform for people. And the more shareholders make the same suggestions and have the same demands, the more management will have to listen.
And they get coffee, too, now.
They do get coffee at some meetings,
that's
not
right,
at all.
That's right. Matthias Rieker covers banking for the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones Newswires. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Traders on Wall Street were crying in their coffee today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Much tends to be made in the ongoing budget debates in Washington about how the government needs to treat its finances as if it were a family. Spend only what it takes in. Economists disagree on that, but the fact is the government's not like a family in a whole lot of ways. When it needs something, for instance, it can't just go shopping. Whether it's toilet paper or screwdrivers or ground-to-air missiles, what have you, there's a competitive bidding process. The exception is when the government is buying medical supplies, oxygen tanks, for instance, or wheelchairs for Medicare patients. President Obama said this week that that's going to change. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner explains.
For years, if you wanted to sell an oxygen tank to a Medicare patient, all you needed was a license and a willingness to accept Medicare's price. There was no bidding process, no rewards for manufacturers who could sell that tank cheaper at a higher volume.
You know, we'd probably be better if we went on Amazon.com and bought our terrible medical equipment.
Robert Leshevsky is a longtime healthcare consultant. This week, President Obama announced not Amazon.com, but a pretty surprising shift. Following a successful year-long experiment in 9 cities, Medicare will roll out a national bidding process for medical equipment. It's expected to save the government and seniors $42 billion over the next 10 years.
It only makes sense from the market perspective that they go out for bids when they buy something. That's what big business would do. That's what a hospital would do.
But for decades, it's what Congress refused to do. Competitive bidding rewards big manufacturers with economies of scale. This could put a lot of little guys out of business.
There are a lot of little guys, and they have employment in the local districts, and they contact their members of Congress, and usually Congress caves.
Gail Walensky is a former director of Medicare. She's now a senior fellow at Project Hope. She says the future of healthcare reform depends on the government's ability to reward the best performers. And if there was this much political resistance to comparing one wheelchair maker to another, how about when the products are harder to compare, like rewarding the safer hospital or the more effective surgeon? Solving that puzzle, she says, is the key to real reform. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
The morning news is the news today. The streak, ladies and gentlemen, is officially over. The Today Show on NBC has owned the 7 to 9 a.m. hours since 1995. But then last week, ABC got former Today Show host Katie Couric on Good Morning America. And oh, the irony, Nielsen says that was enough to do it. GMA beat the Today Show by 31,000 viewers, a modest margin to be sure, but more than enough for bragging rights. And money, a whole lot of money, because morning news shows are among network television's last reliable cash cows, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
It's dominated the breakfast hour every week for 852 weeks.
From NBC News, this is Today.
Until last week, when more people tuned in to...
This is Good Morning America.
The 16-year streak is broken. How much does it matter? A lot, says Bill Carroll, vice president of Katz Television Group.
The morning shows are the most important profit centers for the networks.
The Today Show brought in more than $480 million in revenue for NBC last year. Good Morning America was second at nearly $300 million.
I saw this coming, year and a half ago when my wife gave up on the Today Show and switched to GMA.
Jeff Jarvis is a journalism professor at the City University of New York. He thinks the Today Show has lost its lead because it's gone in a lighter direction, while Good Morning America has gotten a bit newsier. Jarvis says the win is all the more important because networks have been losing so many traditional profit centers.
Consider the death of the soap opera. Consider the shrinking audience of primetime, which was the old gold mine of network TV.
People still want to watch morning news on TV, and advertisers know it, says Katz Television's Bill Carroll.
There's still the dominant way that viewers wake up in the morning. I think the role they have today will be the role they have the next 5 to 10 years.
Carroll says it remains to be seen if Good Morning America can hold its lead. He notes Today Show host Matt Lauer was away last week. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There's yet another round of what the heck do we do about the European economy talks scheduled for this weekend. Everybody's going to be in Washington for the spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Back home, though, on the continent, the discussion on this issue generally breaks down like this. Germany thinks other European countries ought to be more like Germany, controlling their budgets and improving efficiency. French President Nicolas Sarkozy has promised to do at least some of that if he's reelected this spring. But as Christopher Wirth reports, Germany might have a couple of things to learn from the French as well.
Germany's healthy economy sounds like this. the hum of a factory steadily churning out high-end manufactured goods. The goods are shiny new BMWs rolling off an assembly line in Munich. Germany is ticking along just fine, even as the rest of Europe struggles, says Christian Schultz, an economist at Germany's Berenberg Bank.
Unemployment is at historical lows. Employment is at historical highs.
For Schultz, Germany's prosperity is no mystery. A decade ago, he says the country enacted tough labor reforms that make it easier to hire and fire new workers, something France has yet to do. But while Germany is the economic engine of the Eurozone, Schultz warns that the country is entering what he calls its last golden decade.
Germany has a big demographic problem. After 2020, overall German economic growth will fade away because of the country's shrinking population.
In other words, German factories make more Beamers, but French families make more babies. In central Paris, I met Boris Nyman, Stephanie Mayhew, and their two sons, Stelia and Kostia, in their modest middle-class apartment. France is enjoying something of a baby boom, an advantage as employers replace aging workers in the years ahead. Why are the French so productive? Stephanie Mayhew.
Having a child in France is relatively cheap compared to other countries. This is it. This is France.
That is, the French government spends more than countries like Germany on generous childcare policies that help parents raise their kids. At age three, Stelio just learned his ABCs at a state-subsidized preschool that only cost around $180 a month. Three-month-old Kostia goes to daycare for free.
And we, in addition, he's provided with food, milk, so everything is provided.
Provided free. Mom and dad don't pay a dime. Monica Queser is an expert on such family-friendly policies at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris. She says when you add in other perks, like flexible working hours for parents, it all appears to do the trick.
The availability of childcare, according to research, seems to be one of the major factors in encouraging couples, families, to have more children and not fear the dichotomy between work and family.
Which is why Christian Schultz at Berenberg Bank says even though economically France would benefit by modeling itself after Germany.
Germany has to come up with the same type of reforms as France has in the past to change their demographic outlook.
But nearly everyone admits there's no quick fix. Even if Germany's population were to start growing today, it takes a long time before babies are ready for the workforce. In Paris, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Coming up, you remember the Deepwater Horizon oil spill down in the Gulf? Where'd all that oil go?
It's using it as a food source, as a carbon source, just like you and I consume food.
All right. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow Industrial sagged 68 points on this Thursday. That's about a 0.5%, closed at 12,964. The NASDAQ fell 23 points, 0.75% to finish at 3,007. The S&P 500 gave back 8 points. Half of 1% ended things at 1376. Unemployment, home sales, and manufacturing data weighed on the markets, but some companies did shine. eBay saw its share price bid up 13% after first quarter earnings beat forecasts. The New York Times rose 4.4% after it published some positive news about itself. That'd be a bigger quarterly profit. We told you ABC's Good Morning America bested the Today Show in ratings last week. No payoff yet, though, for ABC corporate parent Walt Disney. Shares fell nearly 1% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. It's the 13th anniversary of the Columbine High School massacre in Colorado. The spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank convene in Washington. And you've seen his work in River's Edge and Back to the Future, among many other films. Crispin Glover turns 48. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As of this moment, the three major stock indices are, if not at record highs, then certainly at levels you might not expect given the soft-ish economy. But what Americans think about the markets and where to put their money? Well, that's a whole nother ballgame.
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. He's with us every week for an attitude check, our partnership exploring what Americans think about the news of the day, or in this case, news about where the Dow closed. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you, Kai.
So where do Americans like to put their money here in the spring of 2012?
Well, gold.
Really?
Yeah, we gave them five choices. Actually, we have a longer-term trend that we did not include gold in. We said, where should you put your money, real estate, stocks, savings accounts, or bonds? And that's rather mixed. But we also threw gold into the mix last year and this year, and gold actually wins. Not by a huge margin, mind you, but 28% of Americans say gold is the best place for my money right now, best long-term investment. Real estate's down at 20, stocks 1 point below that at 19, and then under the mattress, savings account is also at 19. So gold wins out.
Okay, here's why that's troubling. You always hear people on, gee, I don't know, business and economic programs, when they offer the price of gold, they always say it's the traditional safe haven when things are going absolutely down the toilet.
Well, people are not rational. Let me give you an example. How's that for an insight?
Yeah, right.
When it comes to investments, obviously, you should buy more stocks when stocks are down. But we found, for example, in 2009, when the market was way down, only 15% of Americans said stocks were the best investment. Mm-hmm. That was the low point. Actually, that's when they should have been sinking money into stocks and so on. So people are not as shrewd investors probably as you or listeners are at this point. So they're kind of reacting to the idea that right now with all the turmoil, maybe because of the television commercials, gold sounds like a safe haven.
But let me ask you this, though. I mean, is it true that Americans are not in the stock market like they used to be?
That is true. This goes all the way back to 1998, and it's a simple question which says, do you or jointly with a spouse have any money in the market through an individual stock or a mutual fund or a 401k or an IRA? It was 60% back in 1998 who said yes to that question. These are 18-plus adults. It reached a high of 67% in 2002, and it's drifted around since then. But this year, when we ask it, it's only 53%. Just a little more than half of Americans are now in the market, and that is the lowest that we have ever measured going all the way back to 1998.
Do you ask the why question?
We don't ask why, although obviously from what we've been talking about, it's because they think they should be in gold. Age is a huge factor here. Young people just don't have money in the market, which you say, all right, they don't have the money to invest yet. But when we say, what's the best investment, young people totally don't mention stocks, particularly those under 30. They say real estate or savings accounts. So psychologically, the younger American today simply isn't attuned to stocks. It doesn't look like to us is a positive place to put money.
Wow. I want to back you up and end on this note. Did I hear you say that 19% of Americans think sticking it under your mattress is the best place to put your money?
Well, I broadened that. The actual category that we use was savings accounts or CDs.
All right.
But given that those are paying 0% interest now, I assumed that was the same thing as putting money under the mattress.
Fair enough. Frank Newport, he's the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The partnership we do with him every week is called Attitude Check. There's more of it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
You bet.
It's 2 years tomorrow since the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 people were killed. The rig was destroyed. And by the time the wellhead was capped 87 days later, nearly 5 million barrels of crude had poured into the Gulf. Studies put the costs in the multiple billions of dollars for the fishing industry, the energy industry, tourism, and environmental damage. And the cleanup continues to this day. One of the big questions people are trying to answer down there is where all that oil went. Alex Chadwick, the host of the public radio series Burn, an energy journal, went to find out.
Port Fourchon, Louisiana, with the last fragment of Mississippi Delta, a barrier island 9 miles long, 200 yards wide, the Gulf on the south, a marsh on the north. It stormed so hard the last 2 days, local schools closed. I see more squalls coming in the Gulf. And John Pardue glances at the weather and then turns back to study the dark, damp gray sand puddled from storm surge last night or from the rain.
The water and the waves and the erosion that's happened over the last 24 hours has exposed these areas.
He's an environmental engineer from Louisiana State in Baton Rouge, and he's looking for oil residue. This island is part of a reserve. He's trying to both help clean it and study the impact of the spill.
What you begin to realize when you're out here is that when you don't see it, it's tend to be buried by the sand. So
just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not here.
Doesn't mean it's not here.
Deepwater Horizon was only about 40 miles away. This shore was hit pretty hard. Now Dr. Pardue stops, and he bends down to a small clump.
This is an oil mat that was exposed by this recent storm overnight. This is oil that's been deposited on the beach and then been uncovered as the sand has washed away.
It looks like a kind of a small, sandy brownie.
Exactly. It certainly is, unless you knew it was oil. If you walked upon it on the beach and started touching it, you wouldn't know that that's what it was.
The clumps are slightly darker than the sand, slightly chocolate. Now I see many of them pocking the surface. Lightning flashes 3 miles offshore. There are oil tankers out there and maybe a dozen drilling platforms.
You see all those oil platforms off there. Those are all operating platforms?
Some of them are random, but many of them are. This is definitely a working coast. You come down here and you're on the beach, but you're seeing a lot of oil activity immediately offshore.
There are accidental spills, hundreds a year, almost all of them small. But even without spills, the Gulf of Mexico has so much oil that maybe 1 million barrels seep naturally out of the seafloor every year. Dr. Pardue has been studying this ecosystem for decades, especially the role of microbes, bacteria. That natural oil seep coming out of the seafloor, they eat it.
So it's using it as a food source, as a carbon source, just like you and I consume food.
They're too small to see. One cell creatures, a million of them would fit in the space of a pencil eraser.
The whole idea that microbes are eating oil, I've read this before, but still it's hard to kind of accept that because you don't think of oil as being anything that you could eat.
Oil is a product of organic matter that was deposited many, many years ago. It's gone through many, many changes deep in the earth under high pressure, high temperature. But fundamentally, it's an organic material.
This is hard to grasp. Oil is food, an organic buffet for microbes. So 2 years ago, when the BP oil plumed in the water, very soon the bacteria plumed too. Different kinds in different parts of the ecosystem, deep water, shallow, shoreline, but they all eat oil, and a lot of it, and quickly.
And so as long as the oil is available, as long as the bacteria can get access to it, and all the conditions are right for their growth, then you start seeing very dramatic kinds of changes that can happen over a short period of time.
It's not just the microbes. Some of the oil burned off, some evaporated, some on the surface was swept up by skimmers, and some of it dispersed. But Dr. Pardue estimates the microbes are degrading about 20% and maybe as much as 40% of all that came out of Deepwater Horizon. The goop that washed up ashore in the days and weeks after the spill smothered whatever it encountered, and you recall the pictures. Thousands and thousands of birds dead or injured, along with sea turtles and dolphins and whales. The exact numbers are still uncertain. But the oil that reached the shoreline was not the same as what erupted out of the seafloor. The lightest elements, the most toxic, had evaporated. What washed up was not so dangerous and lasting. Gunk smeared on wildlife and marshes is bad, but there should not be what scientists call legacy effects, lingering deaths from toxins. What should we do about all that oil? Political leaders were pushing scientists hard for an answer, some techno-wizardry, to get rid of it all. And the answer was nothing. We should do nothing. The marsh habitat is delicate. Tromping all over it will make things worse. Leave it to the microbes. And after a flurry of beach cleanup and bird rescue, and as hard as it is to do nothing in a crisis, that's what they did. The sweepers are gone now. The fires are out. The microbes are continuing to enjoy an extended free lunch.
As the oil disappears, they die off, but there's a core group of bacteria there that are able to respond when the spill, in fact, happens.
When I hear you say this, I think to myself, the world has got some kind of immune system.
Certainly these bacteria break things down in a predictable way, a consistent way, and they tend to be around to respond to lots of different kinds of things.
Dr. John Pardue, an environmental engineer from Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. He's studying the lessons from the big oil spill 2 years ago, and the way oil development goes in the Gulf will likely need those lessons again, and the tools we used last time, and the microbes. In Port Fouchon, Louisiana, I'm Alex Chadwick for Marketplace.
Alex is the host of the public radio series Burn, an energy journal. It's from Sound Vision Productions. It's produced in association with APM. Special thanks also to the National Science Foundation.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which I first saw on Barry Ritholtz's blog, The Big Picture. Turns out the Yes Men, the prankster activist group, I guess you'd call them, well, they've struck again. This time Bank of America was the unfortunate object of their attention. They put up a website called Your Bank of America, featuring too rich by half and also completely fake customer testimonials. Here's one. I want my bank to stop acting as if its motto is, "What would Satan do?" Also, I'm your money. You shouldn't have to pay fees to get to me. It's pretty funny, actually. What is sad is that at least one news organization thought the whole thing was real. There's a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave back 68 points, about a half percent. The NASDAQ off 23 points, 3/4%. The S&P 500 down 8 points, a half percent. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.